From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, our full plate series on agriculture in southeastern Wisconsin continues with a segment on urban beekeeping. It turns out that bees need cities, and cities need bees.
Where the bees are out in our fields where we practice agriculture, it's actually harmful for them. Our urban areas and our cities have more biodiversity and are more abundant and offer a more diverse diet for the bees than you'd think.
Then Boswell Book Company's Daniel Golden shares his can't-miss summer reading list, including a surprising book about the life of long-haul movers.
We completely vilify them. You know, if your cousin, sister's dentist, babysitter's mother had something go wrong with their move, the entire industry is at fault.
And we'll have the latest edition of our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first.
Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. All summer, Lake Effect is presenting a series on Wisconsin agriculture that we call Full Plate. Most of us think of agriculture, though, as a rural thing. But growing food doesn't always occur in the country. From city-based commercial operations like Growing Power to personal backyard or even balcony herb and vegetable gardens, urban agriculture in Wisconsin's largest city is booming.
But no matter where they are, the one thing all gardens have in common is the need for pollination. And when we think of pollination, most of us think of honey. Honeybees. The rooftop of Redeemer Lutheran Church on 19th in Wisconsin is host to three flourishing hives. Maggie Stang was one of the people who helps maintain them.
Stang joined me in the studio just before she left the area to take up an AmeriCorps volunteer position on the West Coast. She explained how she became an urban beekeeper.
I just graduated from Marquette University, and during my time at Marquette, I helped out at a meal program at a church called Redeemer Lutheran Church on 19th in Wisconsin, and we have a lunch meal program most days of the week for anybody in the neighborhood who needs a warm lunch. One day, I was there finishing up, cleaning up with some of the other students, and the pastor there, Pastor Lisa, said to me, "Do you want to come meet the bees on the roof?" I was like, "What are you talking about?" And so we went up to the roof, and there I saw a beehive, and I met a beekeeper named Charlie. And he was speaking about the bees in such wonderful, mystical terms and explaining the ways that they pollinate our neighborhood. And really, from that moment on, I was absolutely hooked.
Did you know anything about bees before that?
I knew the minor stuff that most people know, you know that they're important for pollination. But then I didn't know the extent to which they were so important and also how just amazing they are and their communities are. And then I heard a few months later that the church was hoping to get some of the meal program guests involved in the beekeeping on the roof. And that's when I knew that it was something that I needed to be involved in because I really loved that meal program and had gotten to know a lot of people there.
So this is agriculture and social justice all rolled into one.
Yeah, we definitely try to keep it community-oriented as much as about bees.
So you have a couple of hives up on the roof. How much honey does that produce?
So we have three hives on the roof, and each hive is a different type of hive. So one is called a top bar hive, which is best for educational purposes, produces a little bit less honey versus a Langstroth box hive. It's kind of what you picture, you know, those white boxes stacked on top of each other, people in bee suits.
And then you lift up.
You lift up those and put another one underneath, and mm-hmm. those can produce, you know, gosh, a given you're up to, 100, pounds of honey, more or less. Kind of depends where you are and what the year looks like. So we do jar and sell that honey out of the church, but a lot of our work focuses on the community education aspect.
So how are people reacting? I mean, most people think of bees as things to stay away from.
Right.
You know, particularly if they've grown up in a city, you don't want to be stung and you think this is just some insect that's going to hurt me.
Definitely. And I think that a big part of it is what we do is we try to explain the situation. We kind of explain to people that given our current agricultural system, where the bees are out in our fields where we practice agriculture, it's actually harmful for them. For a variety of reasons, the bees are dying and they're being weakened. And so in reality, even though you wouldn't assume it, our urban areas and our cities have more biodiversity and are more abundant and offer a more diverse diet for the bees than you'd think. So when we practice urban beekeeping, we're creating healthier bees and allowing people to have a better idea of where their food comes from and kind of think about, you know, is my food local? Where am I getting that from? Is my food as healthy as I think it is? And kind of brings people together around those conversations as well. So we try to explain kind of holistically the whole situation and kind of lure people up to the roof to say, you got to meet them. You know, they're not going to bug you. They're actually defensive. And unless they feel threatened, they might throw you a sting, but usually not. And when we describe to people that it's an issue that involves every single one of us, we all eat, we all value our fruits and veggies, then people feel kind of immediately included. And when I explain, you know, how magical they are, they kind of get a little sense of curiosity. And overcoming that fear on the roof is something that's really special to witness.
Talk a little bit about that magic. What makes them magical?
Gosh, there are so many things that make bee communities magical. So there are a lot of working parts. Most people are familiar with the queen bee, and they think that she kind of runs the whole show. But it's really about everybody working together. And while the queen does lay all of the eggs, it's all about what the worker bees are doing. So, I mean, it's hard for me to think of another community, another species that creates their own home and their own food and also has a symbiotic, mutually beneficial relationship with basically everything around it. So not only is it creating that fruit so that we can eat it, but they're going home and creating their own food from that pollen, and they're creating their own homes from that pollen and that nectar. And they're incredibly resourceful. They're not wasteful. Every bee has a place in the hive. Every bee does its job to its full extent. And I think that's just something you don't see that often. And I think being able to see that helps us think about, you know, how can our communities be more resourceful? How can our communities be more community-oriented in the way that everybody has a place, everybody has a voice, everybody is cared for in a greater way? And so that's been really inspirational for us, is how can we learn from the little bits and the little specific things bees do to help each other be more community-oriented.
Now, is there a particular type of honeybee that you're working with, or are there different species of bees that help pollinate?
Yeah, there are lots of different species of bees. We're working with the honeybees specifically in our hives, but you'll also see, you know, bumblebees are those fuzzy, larger ones that kind of bumble around, and they really are solitary, so less community-oriented. There are carpenter bees that you'll see, other ones as well. And then, of course, people always associate the wasps and the hornets, which also live a little bit differently, and they create their nests out of different things like paper and not.
But are they pollinators as well?
Yeah, especially the bumblebees and carpenter bees. And yeah, they definitely play their part. But the honeybees are responsible for up to a third of what we eat, usually is what we say, you know, one every three bites that you eat was probably pollinated by a honeybee.
So I understand, you know, you said you graduated.
Yeah.
And you're going off to Minneapolis in the fall, is that correct?
Well, I'm from Minneapolis, just graduated from Marquette, and in the beginning of August, I'll be going out to Tacoma, Washington, and I'm doing a year with the Jesuit Volunteer Corps. I have an AmeriCorps position, and I'll be working out there. And one amazing thing is that there's a church down the road from where I live that has a bee project, so I think there was a little bit of fate involved there.
A little synergy happening.
Yeah, so I'm excited about that.
Do you hope to continue with apiary studies?
Yes, absolutely. I think that bees are a really amazing unifier for people, and that when you think about how we all are connected to the plight and cause of bees, you can really bring together some different perspectives that aren't usually in the same room. You know, whether it's a beekeeper who's been beekeeping for 15 years, or a college student, or somebody who just got housing after being homeless for 5 years, or a kid from down the street. You know, when you're all on the roof and looking at bees, we're all learning together and we're all thinking more seriously about our part in our environment and in our city. So I think that it's something that I can stay involved in wherever I am.
Are you hoping that the people that you work with here, that they'll take up urban beekeeping?
Yes. So, I mean, the great thing about urban beekeeping is that there's a spectrum of involvement. Maybe you just want to be someone who has a small victory garden and you're more conscious of what you plant. Or maybe you want to help out, you know, on the roof of the church down the street and you want to learn a little bit more about bees before you get your own hive. Or maybe you're ready to jump right in and get a hive and take care of it. So there's a range, and we find that people kind of inch closer and closer And then when they do get that hive, we like to help them out and make sure that it's thriving.
Say I, you know, decide I have a little patio on my backyard and I've got some trees and there are certainly birds around and I've seen butterflies and that sort of thing. How do I set up a little hive, both for myself if I want to harvest the honey, but also to make sure that the bees are healthy?
Sure. There are a variety of people in the city, like, for example, Charlie, the beekeeper I work with.
Charlie Keenan?
Yes, Charlie Keenan. Mm-hmm. He could help you get set up with a hive. It'd be a specific type of hive, like you said, based on what you want. If you were more focused on, you know, a little bit of honey and pollination for your neighborhood, he'd probably set you up with a top bar hive. He'd position it in a good spot for you that's considerate of where the bees come and go. And beyond that, this is what Charlie would say, is being a beekeeper is about being a pattern recognitionist. And so what you generally do is you're trying your best to let the bees be and do what they do because they know it better than we do. And then you're taking note of what's going on inside the hive so that you can help them do their job better. So when you're looking through, you're noting, you know, where are the baby bees and where are they storing honey and where are they bringing in pollen and is it getting a little bit crowded in the hive and do you need to add a bar or two so they can grow out to avoid a, you know, a swarm in your neighborhood to have your neighbor call on you. That's the kind of thing that creates healthy bees and creates a nice little supply of honey for you and your neighbors at the end of the season.
So if people want to come to the church and see the hives that are there, can they just show up or come for lunch, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I would say come for lunch or, you know, on Sundays we try to do, you know, after church and after lunch, sometimes we bring groups up for tours. You know, feel free to drop us a note too. You know, today we had a group of 27-year-olds from another church up the street and, you know, the next day we might have a group, you know, of 10, you know, elderly people from down the road. So we're really open to anybody who wants to come see the bees, as long as they've got a curiosity.
Well, I am so happy that we were able to get in touch and get you in here to talk about this. Thank you so much, Maggie.
Of course.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Maggie Stang recently graduated from Marquette University and has headed west to Tacoma, Washington, where she'll spend the next year as an AmeriCorps volunteer. She's one of 12 people featured in the Local Lights cover story of this month's Milwaukee Magazine.
The beehives that Maggie spoke about are on the roof right under the steeple of Redeemer Lutheran Church, which is at the corner of 19th and Wisconsin. You can find out more and hear the rest of our full plate segments at WUWM.com.
Coming up next, a chance to burnish your summer reading list. Daniel Golden of Boswell Book Company offers some suggestions when Lake Effect Weekend continues on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Welcome back to Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Summer is a time for a lot of us to catch up on some reading, even those of us who often have to read books for a living.
For those of us whose tastes extend beyond the bestseller lists, Daniel Golden is here to offer some suggestions. He is the proprietor of Milwaukee's Boswell Book Company. Hi, Daniel. Thanks for stopping by.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So you have a big stack of books on the table in front of you, as you often do when you come to visit. And these are all books that we're sort of categorizing as good summer reads. Let's start with a kid's read and or a young adult read. And this is actually something that I believe your colleague mentioned on the air a few months ago.
Yes, I want everybody to know that I listen to everybody's advice. And I do get to read kids' books, not as many as I'd like, of course. But it, in fact, Amy, our kids' buyer, this has been one of the books that she's been hot on, came out in May. You know, it's one of those things, if I go listen to people talk about a book enough and it hits me, I want to read it too. And so the book in question is Orphan Island by Laurel Snyder. It is, I would say, officially 8 and up. I think it's such an odd book that it could creep higher than their top edge, though, honestly, we see so many adults reading kids' books that the top level of those kids' books doesn't mean anything.
But I think in terms, it sounds like, I have not yet read it,
yeah.
But from what I gather, it does not necessarily tie itself up into a neat bow at the end, which might be difficult for some of the youngest readers to appreciate.
Oh, that's yes. That's one of the things I really love about the book. And it is my feeling that actually it might bother more adults than kids. So it's about, it's Orphan Island. So there's 9 kids. And they are in this sort of flux time. The story opens with a green boat coming into the harbor with a very young child on it. The child gets off. They welcome the kid. He goes to one of the children. And the oldest child, who is the elder, gets in the boat as per custom. And the boat takes him away into the distance. And the second oldest kid becomes the new elder. And the little baby, in this case a girl, becomes her charge. And she has to teach the baby to do some things and over the next year, and also lead the group and also not break various rules. And if they don't break the rules, they catch their fish and the plants grow right. But if they break a rule, like they pick the last plant, there are no more plants anymore, you know, of that kind.
So it's like a metaphor for society.
It's a metaphor for – it's just there's so many metaphors in this book. I'm just like – but it's so much fun. And I call it Lost for Kids. It is got that sort of like, I don't know what's going on. And as you're reading the book, you think of all these ideas. So the new kid, Ginny, she's the new elder. And the problem is she's having trouble teaching. She's going through changes in her life. She's being distracted. And she thinks maybe she doesn't want to go. And that's all I'm going to say about it, except you can't not talk about the book afterwards. You really want other people to read it. We talked to at least one adult who could not stand it. But there's clearly many people who love this book. So
that is Laurel Snyder's Orphan Island, which when we talked to Amy, the book was not yet out. The book is out now.
It's out now. And hit our bestseller list 1 week. So
outstanding. All right. So let's jump around to something by a writer named Finn Murphy called The Long Haul, which is directly in front of you. It's interesting. I'm looking at two books and I see a trend in cover design.
There's a little, yes, there is. There's a number of things going on. So this is sort of got, they both, Long Haul has sort of takes the road and the fields it's going through and turns it into stripes. This is a memoir about trucking. And just as an aside, this kind of washed out, muddy brown look is very popular in covers nowadays. It doesn't seem like a pretty cover. You don't think that people would buy clothes in this color, for example. I might. And one other thing that's hot are these sort of subculture memoirs. And whereas I learned about Orphan Island from Amy, this was a pick from Jason, our adult buyer. One of the things Jason did this year, which was really exciting, was he was on the Indies Introduced panel. And that is a group of booksellers, I think around 10, who pick first books, not even first novels. It's first book, adult and kids. There's two panels, actually, and that booksellers around the country are going to promote to sort of help break them out. And what that did is that led him to read a lot of books. He's always a fast reader, but he really read out of his comfort zone. And this is one of the books he couldn't stop talking about. It is a trucker, but a special kind of trucker, a long-haul mover. And those are the people who take your stuff and to California. Finn Murphy is an excellent mover. One of the things you learn is movers are low truckers on the totem pole. The other truckers don't want anything to do with them. They ridicule them. If you go into a truck stop, you probably can't sit at the counter with them. And even though often the long-haul movers make more money, but it's considered, I don't know, it's not tough enough. And he's been doing this a long time. He actually dropped out of college then gave up for a while and then went back. And he tells you it's sort of a philosophical book. It's a political book. He looks at the changes in the business, why it becomes sort of a variation on hillbilly elegy or white trash, because he talks about why it's so hard to find the traditional people who are doing the long haul moving who don't want to do it anymore. There's lots of crazy stories. You hate You hate a lot of people, but you also love people. I mean, the other thing about long-haul movers is, like, we completely vilify them. You know, if your cousin's sister's dentist babysitter's mother had something go wrong with their move, the entire industry is at fault. And we don't think about that with other people. I mean, you know, someone has a botched gallbladder operation and we don't vilify all doctors. But after this book, you'll see kind of the things they go through. I love subculture. I love the special language. And he's got a really great voice. He's a terrific writer, too.
So that's The Long Haul by Finn Murphy. And let's jump around a little bit.
Okay.
This one is not out yet, but it will be out midsummer. Let's talk about Tom Perata's new novel, Mrs. Fletcher, which I will say I am partway through, and it makes me a little antsy.
Isn't it so uncomfortable? I mean, this is the thing that I love about Tom Perata. I have read everything, oddly enough, but one book. You have to save one for, like, you know, a really bad, something bad happened to you. You're like, well, at least I've got a Tom Perata.
Well, and for people who are not familiar with Tom Perata, he wrote The Wishbones. He wrote Election, which—
So several things that became movies. So Election, which was the a big film. Little Children, which I think got an Academy Award nomination at least. And The Latecomers. Cable series.
Right.
Leftovers. Yep. Oh, my gosh. The first season is based on the novel,
right,
and then the next two seasons aren't. But he did work on the show as well as write the screenplay for at least Election. So his books always, they're suburban life generally, but they're always make you a little uncomfortable. He has dealt with sex before in Little Children. He was dealing a lot with religion, and this is definitely back to sex. It's about basically the story of a divorced mom and her son dealing with the new world of sexual freedom and sexual taboo. And basically, he is a classic. The boy is a classic Tom Perata bro. If you've read his books before, you might know the bro from Election or Little Children. And he goes to school and learns the true, you know, the state of sexual politics, which I guess was not really there in high school. And then his mom becomes a little obsessed with online porn. yeah, there are no
two ways about that.
It is so funny. It is so smart. And boy, it is uncomfortable. And I loved it. I loved being uncomfortable.
I know you are a huge fan of Don Lee. We should mention Don Lee's latest. He was just here, right?
He was. And I love him so much. And this was a case like Tom Perata, I'm still working on. Tom Perata, I just met him for the first time. So maybe another time he'll come to Milwaukee. But Don Lee, I've been crazy about him since his first short story collection, Yellow, which was about Asian Americans of all kinds. Very funny. Set in a town called Rosarita Bay. Everything I love about short stories. Like funny, smart, interconnected, controversial a little. Then he's written a thriller. He's written a sort of art novel, college novel. And then he wrote one of my favorite novels of all times, Rack and Rune, which is also set in Rosarita Bay, as is this. They're companion novels. He writes about cultural identity. He writes about artistic identity. He writes about family identity. And in this book, he writes a little about class identity, too. So it's about a failed alt-country singer, a songwriter, was in North Carolina, about to make it. Very talented guy, had a partner. Of course, he was in love with her. He had a few problems. He was he had stage fright. He was a little too chunky, and he was Korean. So, you know, it's just sometimes not so easy in the alt-country world. So he doesn't make it. He runs out on it, and he decamps back to California, where he becomes a carpet installer. He has a girlfriend. She runs the company. You know, her father runs the company. And but he has that creative urge, and he sees the woman he dumped, who completely sold out and became a commercial country singer and then an actress, and she's at the resort where he's installing carpet, and he thinks this might be his last chance. But the problem is he also has Meniere's disease now, so he's losing his hearing. And it's once again so great. I love – this is such an interesting thing to me because he writes about cultural identity, but in this case, he writes about it by not writing about it. There's no physical descriptions of anybody. You can catch some sort of ethnicities by their last names, and sometimes you don't even know what he was thinking of. But let me just say that it's a very diverse cast. I
completely want to read this book
now.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I brought a copy for you if you didn't have one.
I do not have one. We'll leave that part out.
It's a really – the other thing is I read a lot of music novels. And let me just say that some of them don't get it. And I can't say any of them because booksellers only say nice things. But this guy really understands music and creativity. And a lot of times people use writers use music and art and theater sort of as metaphors for the writing life. But in this case, I think it goes beyond metaphor. He actually worked with a guy, Will Johnson, singer-songwriter from Austin, I believe, who does play in Milwaukee, Shank Hall and The Rave and living room shows. And he actually wrote the lyrics in the book. And because sometimes writers get trashed for writing really crappy lyrics. I'm saying, you know, Visit from the Goon Squad. I mean, there are plenty of really great music novels, but there are also some really bad ones. But this is, it's just, I don't know, I just want to, like, there's some books where I just read the books and sigh and hug them. And, you know, and he, you know, this guy's a pain, a bit of a pain. But he's not like an unlikable, he's not an anti-hero. You know, that's another list of books.
All right, so that was Don Lee's latest book. Let's jump to something different. Hunger, Roxane Gay.
Well, this is a book that I've read two Roxane Gay books before. We were able to host her in her formative years. Now she's completely exploded and selling out huge. It's like she's like a Beatles of writers, but
she's playing Shea Stadium.
Sharon, one of my booksellers, is a huge fan of hers, and read Hunger, A Memoir of My Body, and was talking about it. And then I got another writer wrote to me, and actually Ann Patchett, who's on the back cover, and said, "Why haven't you read this book yet?" So I thought I better read this, and I'm very interested. I've read actually books before about weight, and I think I used to say this like 25 years ago. You know, that weight was the one prejudice that you could have in society without any repercussions, and I think that's really changing now with Lindy West and you know, other Samantha Irby, a lot of people speaking up more about it, and certainly Roxane Gay. The thing about this book, it's fragmentary. And some of the pieces, it all runs together, but and it's all about body image and comfort with it and discomfort with it and the terrible incident that led to her not having a weight problem to having a weight problem and or not a problem, but putting on the weight to sort of protect herself. I mean, she was in a brutal sexual assault, and when she was very young and did not tell her family. In fact, her family did not know until Bad Feminist came out. She's a really great writer. She's very smart. I can't say that there's a lot of really happy essays, you know, unlike Bad Feminist, but she does really love her some Ina Garten. So so there's that. But I think she's not always happy. You know, she's the kind of person who says what she thinks and doesn't make everybody happy. I think nowadays anything you say will probably inflame, oh, I don't know, 50% of the population. And unlike in the past, you'll know about it afterwards. So my apologies to the 50% of the people that I said everything wrong to right now. Anyway, it's a really terrific book. It's very raw. You know, she, you know, not too long a read. You can't really put it down, so you read it straight through.
All right, so we're a little time limited. Let's do some quick hits on these last handful of books that you have along, just because we should mention them, starting with Adriana Trigiani.
Well, this is I think this is truly a summer read, and it is a big, sprawling family novel, kind of with a romance at its center, a bit of a comedy, historical, very old-fashioned, set in Philadelphia.
It's called Kiss Carlo.
Kiss Carlo. All of Adriana Trigiani's books have not all of them, but many of them have like family businesses at the center. This is about two competing cab companies who have two brothers who've split, and the sort of the nephew who's beloved by all, who doesn't really want to work for either of them. He wants to be an actor at the theater company. She's coming to the Wilson Center on June 12th. It's our first collaborative event.
July 12th.
Collaborative event with Books & Company in Oconomowoc and the Sharon Lynn Wilson Center for the Arts. So we're hoping it goes really well. We hear from Waukesha County that they want, would like us to do more programming there. And I have to say, she's a winner. She's so much fun. She's everybody's best friend. She's a performer, and it's going to be really great. So... And I like the book. It's 522 pages, but I read it all.
Okay. How about one that you were reading as you walked in the door today, The Ready-Made Thief?
Yes. I looked at this list and said, I do not have a thriller. And I read some thrillers. I read a few in the spring. I read a few in the fall, coming out in the fall. But I didn't have something for summer. Augustus Rose is a first-time novelist. He teaches at the University of Chicago. So it's definitely a literary thriller. And it is about a young woman who has basically been on the streets, sort of kicked out of her family, and finds herself falling into this weird organization that may be destroying the minds of young kids. She's on the run from them. It seems to have to do with Marcel Duchamp. And let me just say that there's almost a speculative element in it. It's definitely like Da Vinci Code in two levels. It's a puzzle novel, and the artist's work is very, very important to the book. This is another book that's on the Indies introduced. There's tons of bookseller recommendations around the country. Jason, love the book. I think we've had 5 people read it in the store. I haven't seen comparisons to it, but The Eight is one of the books that people have compared it to a lot. I thought Shadow of the Wind would probably be one. I haven't seen that yet, so I'll have to find out. But definitely they've also said Rule of Four has been one that's come up a lot. You know if you're that kind of person, and I hope you are, because it's a really fun summer read. It comes out also August 1st. So.
All right. It's a great list. We will have it on our website. Daniel Golden, thank you as always.
Oh, thank you as well.
Daniel Golden is the owner of Milwaukee's Boswell Book Company. You will find his full list of summer reads at WUWM.com.
We'll take one more break, and then it is time for our storytelling series, Ex-Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend continues in a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Three, two, one.
Welcome to Ex-Fabula!
True personal story.
Ex-Fabula!
Ex-Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
Ex-Fabula Radio Time, part of Lake Effect Weekend, every weekend at this time. I'm Bruce Winter with Ex-Fabula co-founder Leah Delaney with stories for you, as we have every weekend. And here we are in Milwaukee, the city of festivals, in the highest month of high festival season around here.
Yeah, we really are in the apex of the festival season.
I can't be everywhere.
No, I know. Although I'm sure a lot of people expect you to be everywhere, but
well, I try and make as many as I can, but sometimes it's just overwhelming. The calendar is full.
I mean, we have the end of Summerfest, 50th anniversary. We have Vive la France. We have Bastille Day coming up next weekend, and then we also have Blow Up the Beach, which is a fun family tradition held in Bayview for the Bayview South Shore Frolics.
Yes, South Shore Frolics.
So everything's going to blow up. Milwaukee's going to blow up with beer and fun and fireworks that weekend.
Indeed. Let's celebrate.
Let's celebrate Vive la France style with our first story today. Here's Paula Mason.
So the story has to do with one
very excited high school girl who was the president of her French club and really geeked out about French. I watched Amelie too many times. We went on field trips to French restaurants in Milwaukee. And we also, my family had lots of exchange students stay with us through a teacher at my school. So I felt like I was ready for that same experience. And the summer between my junior and senior year of high school, I had saved up enough money to do my own study abroad for a month. And I went through all the processes to get ready for that. I found out the name of my family, how many kids they had, etc. And I just get ready. And I boarded my plane, and four flights later, horrible, I arrive at my destination with my giant bag of luggage completely lost. So that alone would have been a little bit of, you know, a hassle, but that's okay. I had my backpack and my optimism, and I was alone, by the way, because the group that I went with, we all were placed in different parts of France. So we had arrived in Paris together, but I arrived in the city where I was staying by myself. And I just knew that they would be waiting for me at the airport. And it kind of boggles my brain, but when I got off the plane, it had those little stairs that lead out onto the tarmac, and there were people already waiting on the tarmac. It kind of had like an open air feel to it. And because I had lost my luggage, I didn't need to really go inside the airport, and I had already been through customs in Paris. And I see a man on the tarmac who has a picture of me, and he has packets of stuff that I had sent months earlier, and we'll call him Monsieur L. So I approach him. I see he's looking at me. I'm looking at him. I don't see any family in sight, and at that point, you know, we talk, and my French was painfully, awkward, stumbling, not very good, and we confirm that we are, you know, he's the father of the host family I'm staying with. So I go with him, and I'm asking a little bit. I thought it was a little strange that the kids weren't there. There was supposed to be a girl my age. And we get on a bus, and he takes me to an apartment building. And I'm like, what's this about? You know, like, okay, maybe the family lives in an apartment. And it's in the downtown area of a university town. So there's all sorts of young people around. It feels really cool, but it wasn't what I was envisioning. And he leads me up to to the apartment. And it turns out that it's this tiny little efficiency, just cramped, a sink next to a bed, and there's no family in sight. And so this is the kind of creepy part, but but I start stumbling and saying, where's the girl who's my age, etc. And I just had the sinking feeling. You know, I didn't feel like my physical safety was threatened. I didn't feel that in my gut, but I did feel like something was really wrong. And I was away from home for the first time. And I just asked him, I said, do you have a phone? I need to make a phone call. This isn't right. And he didn't have a phone, but he willingly took me to a payphone. I had to buy a calling card. And this was 2003, so a couple years before I had my first cell phone. And my mind is racing. And he didn't, honestly, he didn't seem like a scary individual, but I got the sense that he wasn't all there. And to clarify, he wasn't going to stay with me at that apartment. He said he was going to camp for a month, and then I would stay there alone, and then we would sightsee during the day. And it's like, this is just ridiculously off. So I am calling the numbers that I had written down, and I know that the coordinator is in a different city, but I knew that there was supposed to be an on-site coordinator in the city that I was staying in. And I left a voicemail. I even called home. I called from France to home, and my parents actually were out, so I spoke to the babysitter of my little sister. And I was just horrified, and I couldn't really get through to anybody. So we hung up the phone, and I just started crying. And it was a busy, like, plaza, a busy, you know, city center. People started coming up to me and asking what was wrong. And I don't think I made sense in French or English. And I just knew that I had to get out of this, but I didn't know where to go. And interestingly enough, he complied this whole time. You know, I don't think he was a bad I don't think he had bad intentions. I think he was just off. And anyway, thankfully, the payphone started to ring, and we pick it up. And on the other line is the coordinator. She was an English teacher at the school in France where my host sister went. And she said, "Paula, where are you? The police are notified. We were waiting for you at the airport. What happened? You never got off the plane." And I said, "I did. I'm with Monsieur L." And I find out that he was estranged from his family. And the reason why he had received that information was because there was a strike, a postal strike, and the mail that I sent got diverted to him. And he got it in his mind that, oh my goodness, I'm going to have an exchange student. And yeah, I mean, but I know that the natural thought is like, oh, it like creepy sexual overtones. In retrospect, I don't think I felt that in my gut, but there was just something really off. And he did want me to stay at his place while he camped. And I just, anyway, so the coordinator is telling me, don't go back in the apartment. We're going to come pick you up. And I ended up staying with the host family, and it did take me a little bit of time to trust them. And I think they were mortified because this was never supposed to happen. I mean, I don't think I was ever supposed to find out about the estranged father, but I would say I'd loosely file this under loss of innocence for the girl, for the girl who was, you know, in love with the movie Amelie and just president of her French club. This was not quite what I was in for, but it ended up being okay. I think I made the best out of it. So, all right.
And that was Paula Mason with her Vive la France story.
I cannot do any kind of French accent. I come off sounding like, you know, Pepe Le Pew or something. I just can't do it.
I end up sounding German somehow. I don't know. I'm terrible.
It just doesn't work.
But we really, really want to encourage everyone to sign up for that Ex Fabula membership. That membership provides so many different benefits. You get swag. You get into secret Fabula events. You get into story slams, advanced show announcements. Being an Ex Fabula member gives you the satisfaction and the self-fulfilling notion that you are a part of Milwaukee. So we really want to encourage everyone to go to exfabula.org to sign up for a membership, find out more details, all that good stuff. So let's get back to the stories. We are still under the theme of festing in Milwaukee. So let's actually do a story from an Only in Milwaukee story slam that we had. This one is from Catherine Miller. Let's hear her story.
My name is Catherine, and I'm an addict. I just love art, and my home is an art gallery. And I've bought over the years anything I can afford to buy: insider art, outsider art, paintings, drawings, sculptures, realism, unrealism. But when I bought a house on Rhode Island Avenue, it was a 1960s house, bought it last summer, and it had this wide open space for art. And I got a Jones for a big ass original abstract piece. But, you know, they cost a lot of money, and the artists deserve it. They're really, really, they take a lot to put an abstract together, the materials and creativity and all that. And I was just a little bit short on the funding by a couple thousand dollars. So, I enjoy the chaotic journey. You know, I like the impossible dream. And so I just go to bed thinking about, ooh, blues or orange, you know, whatever. And so one day I'm tootling down KK, and then, no. Whoa, seriously? Ah! Across the street, at the curb, there's a big-ass original abstract sitting on the curb. Well, It had a little sign on it, and I knew that there's no way I can afford even a yard sale big-ass abstract. But, you know, okay, magnetic attraction, okay, I'm pulling a Yui. I get up there. Oh, no. Really? Seriously? The price is right. I can afford it. It's free! No, praise Jesus, it's free! And it's big by bigger. And it has this fabulous splashes of earth tones and particles of wood and all kinds of materials, metal and glass embedded in the oils. It's wild, marvelous, and it's mine. I have claimed it. So here's the thing. Now I have to get it home. Okay, so how does that work? The painting is this and this, and I have a Toyota Prius. So this has to happen. I know I need help, but I have no one to call. So I see this kid coming toward me. I say, hey, kid. And he looks at me and he pulls out an earbud and says, hey, kid, look, can you come over here and help me get this painting into my car? And he looks at me like, lady, that painting into that car? You're cracked. The kid comes over and we're maneuvering the painting here, there, and everywhere, and of course it doesn't fit. But I have to have it, you see. So I think, okay, I got it. I give him $5 and tell him to walk it home for me. Well, then comes this one-armed guy, grabs my kid. I'd paid him the $5, and there goes the one-armed guy with the kid because he's seen a shelving unit that he wants, and that's free. So I, oh, come on, really? Well, anyway, so I see the one-armed guy has a van. Go over, introduce myself. Joe, I shake his, arm, not hand. And I said, Joe, can you take my painting home? You know, the kid will put it in the car. And he says, so, you pay the kid? Yeah, I paid the kid. I said, okay, sure. 5 minutes later, I had the impossible dream lodged safely in my garage. Kid goes off, he's paid, doesn't need a ride home. I lean in the car to say thank you to Joe and his wife. And they say to me, well, we just live a couple blocks away. We're really neighbors, you know. We're out in New York. And I said, wow, you made my dream come true. And she said, well, that's what neighbors are for. And when I look at that painting now, it's beautiful. It's not really an abstract anymore because I see the artist who created it, splashing paint, finding objects in the neighborhood. I see the kid toting it down the street, putting it in the van. I see Joe and his wife delivering it unto me, and I've created a new genre of art, Milwaukee realism. Thank you very much for your valuable time.
And that was Catherine Miller's Only in Milwaukee story.
You never know where you're going to find objects d'art in Milwaukee. And if it's on a street corner in Bayview or wherever, you just never know. Only in Milwaukee.
That's so true. It's so true. I slowly pass curbs all the time looking for stuff that I can put up on my walls.
Yeah. And people will just put it out there and say, put a little sign on it that says free.
Mm-hmm.
And so remind us again about memberships and where we can go to sign up for that and any other upcoming things.
Will do. Exfabula membership. Be a part of Milwaukee. Be a part of Exfabula. Sign up at exfabula.org. You get all of the benefits listed there.
And you want to hear these stories again or share them with someone, they are up at wuwm.com. So we are here every weekend, Saturday and Sunday at this time. So join us on the air or online. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Ex Fabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up the show today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tighe. Thank you so much for making us a part of your weekend afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned now for Weekend All Things Considered. It's coming up next. It is 4 o'clock.